Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The study of happiness is yielding some hot headlines, like conservatives are happier than liberals, and some cooler ones, like how TV veg-out time is worse than you think. These days, scholars are piling up data about the real roots of happiness, and it's creating a roadmap for potentially improving our well-being. This hour On Point, our gross national happiness. Joining me now from Syracuse, New York, is Arthur Brooks, professor of business and government at Syracuse University. He's also a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. His new book is Gross National Happiness: Why Happiness Matters for America and How We Can Get More of It. Arthur, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
And joining me from Paris, France, is Alan Krueger, professor of economics and public affairs at Princeton University. He's former chief economist at the U.S. Department of Labor under President Clinton. He's co-author with four other scholars of an eight-year landmark study on happiness in America. He's in Paris this week to start work on a commission begun under President Sarkozy to study national well-being in France. Alan, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
And with me here in the studio is Jack Beattie, On Point news analyst and senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. His new book is Age of Betrayal, The Triumph of Money in America, 1865 to 1900. Jack, welcome back.
Hello, Jane, Arthur, and Alan.
So, Professor Krueger, I'll start with you. This study is really the capstone of many years of research. What did you set out to examine?
Well, it's been a remarkable collaboration, and I've been working with four psychologists to try to measure, derive better measures or at least different measures of well-being. So we set out to see if we could come up with a measure of well-being which relates more closely to how people live their lives, how they spend their time, how they feel about it. And we've developed diary-based methods where people record the activities they're doing, who they're doing them with, and how they feel about it along certain dimensions, such as how happy they feel, how sad they feel, how much pain they feel, how angry they feel, how interested they are, and so on. We've been developing this method over the last 8 years, and recently completed a paper summarizing what we found and discussing the results of a survey that the Gallup organization did for us of 4,000 Americans.
Yeah, 4,000 Americans. Well, I'm curious how the diary-based method was important for the study and what that gleaned.
Well, I think people view their lives in at least two ways. There's one way which has been the most common for research is kind of an overall evaluation of people's lives. How satisfied are they with the way their life is going overall? And I think that yields interesting information. But then there's a second way, which is how people experience their lives, how they live moment to moment. And there's a lot of overlap between the two, but they're not identical. And with the diary method, we are able to get more closer to the second concept of how people are experiencing their lives.
And so what were the trends that you found?
Well, some of the trends are really fascinating. One thing we could do is we could group activities into those that are associated with similar emotions. So you already alluded to television. Television seems to be pretty similar for many people to cooking. Kind of moderately enjoyable, moderately unpleasant, not terribly engaging. Work tends to be pretty onerous, which is different than what people often find when we look at general questions about enjoyment and so on. So what we've been able to do is to look over the last 40 years to see which activities have been rising, which ones have been declining. And we get somewhat different trends for men and women. For men, there's been a gradual movement away from the less enjoyable, less pleasant activities like work, more towards kind of neutral activities like watching television. And on that probably has led to an increase in the moment-to-moment pleasure that men experience. And for women, we've seen a large movement towards work and, interestingly, less time spent at home doing housework and also a rise, at least over the last 30 years, in time watching television. And on net, this is probably a slight decline in the way women feel moment to moment. Overall, I would say it looks like women are experiencing more stress they're spending less time socializing and probably feeling a little less enjoyment overall moment to moment.
Arthur Brooks, we'll get into more of the details of this as the hour progresses, but let me turn to you for a moment. As an economist, why try to measure gross national happiness? What's the point of trying to measure something on a grand scale that's really so subjective?
Well, as Alan just pointed out, it's actually less subjective than we generally speaking think. I mean, people know more or less when they're happy moment to moment and basically on some in their life, and they can look at the bad things and happy things that happen to them. And what the research really tells us is that in point of fact, we assess happiness in fairly similar ways and that we can compare our answers. I mean, there's been a lot of fascinating research out there that asks people, you know, how happy do you think you are? And then it compares the answers to what other people say about them and even to the kinds of answers they'll give to tests of how many happy and sad words they can come up with in a limited amount of time. And all of the outside other tests point to the fact that when you ask somebody how happy they are on balance, they're going to give you a reasonably accurate, interesting, useful answer, and that we can compare it between people. So that suggests that it's very imperfect, and the kinds of things that Alan and his co-authors are doing is very important to make the measures better. But we can measure more than we used to think. It's not just, you know, my happiness is completely different than yours. And if we can measure it, you know, this is something that we should be able to think of as a national priority. In point of fact, governments are, which is why Alan is in France right now talking to the president of France about this issue. You know, the founding fathers of the United States said that one of our inalienable rights is the pursuit of happiness. They honestly believed that happiness was something that was not something only that royalty or nobility deserved, that we all should be able to define our happiness and chase after it in the ways that seem suitable to us. And if that's true, then in the spirit of the founding of this country, we should be thinking very seriously about happiness, in my view.
Well, tell us, really, one of the hot headlines out of your research in your book is that conservatives are happier than liberals. How so?
Well, once again, it gets back to asking people how happy they feel they are about their lives, as well as questions that are related to that. And one of the things that you find is that the intuition, at least my intuition as an academic, was always wrong. There was a famous study a couple of years ago by researchers at University of California at Berkeley that, for example, that looked at preschoolers 20 years ago and compared their childhood characteristics to their political views when they had grown up into their early 20s. And one of the interesting things that they found was that the kids who were most emotionally rigid and prone to weeping turned out to be the conservatives. And so the natural conclusion from that is that the conservative mindset is naturally less happy. But at least by the time they grow up, when they're about 40, if you look at the data on how happy they say they are about their lives, that conclusion from that study is not consistent with what we find, because adult conservatives win the happiness game hands down. You find that 44% of adult conservatives say they're very happy versus 25% of adult liberals. Their conservatives say they're more optimistic about their lives. They're less likely to feel like a failure. They're far more likely to judge their mental health as excellent than are either moderates or liberals. And the list goes on and on. Now,
well, so what are the components of that? Is that family? Is that faith? Is that money? I mean, what plays into that?
Well, good question. And it turns out that about half of the difference between liberals and conservatives has to do with demographic characteristics, mostly religion and marriage. Conservatives are much more likely to be religious, which has a lot of favorable impacts on self-described happiness. And marriage is a very good thing for that, too, particularly, obviously, a good marriage. But the other half of the happiness gap between right and left comes down to worldview. And different people describe it in different ways. Alan and his co-author Daniel Kahneman talk about the views on complexity. The conservatives actually have a view of the world as being less complex, less frustrating in a way. I find that conservatives are more likely to believe they're in control of their environment, that they can get ahead, that hard work and perseverance will combat a lack of, you know, opportunities that you're born with. And liberals tend to disagree with that, and that's a more frustrating life.
Mm. What do you make of these claims, Alan Krueger, based on your own research?
Well, to the extent that, you know, we've been able to check, they seem to be fairly robust conclusions. The one thing, and I'd be interested in what Arthur thinks about this. One thing I saw in some data I looked at recently was that independents were actually slightly less satisfied with their lives than were liberals. It wasn't a big difference, but they were a little bit less. I'm curious if that's what he has found.
Hmm. I do. And the interesting thing that I've found to even build on that is that people with extreme political views are much happier than moderates, which, you know, I consider myself a political moderate. It's kind of a mildly alarming finding that the guy in front of you with a radical bumper sticker is who's making you unhappy with it is actually a happier person. You find that really big differences. You know, so for example, you find that people with extreme right-wing views, 48% are very happy versus 43% of moderate conservatives. 35% of extreme liberals are happy, very happy, versus 22% of moderate liberals. And that plays into this gap that where moderates are somewhere in the middle. Perhaps less comfortable, but they understand there's a lot of complexity in the world, and easy solutions based on political dogma elude them to their great unhappiness.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're discussing new research on happiness in America and how it changes our view of well-being. Joining me today are Alan Krueger, professor at Princeton University, Arthur Brooks, professor at Syracuse University and author of the new book, Gross National Happiness, and Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst. To the point about conservatives being happier than liberals, I want to go to the phones right off the bat and hear from Brenda, who's in Jackson, South Carolina, with a question about that. Brenda, go ahead.
Yes. Thank you, Jane.
Yes.
I may have missed it, but over what time horizon was that study done? I'm wondering if a Democrat ends up in the White House, will conservatives still be so happy? In other words, maybe their happiness is largely situational. Another item, it seems telling that the children from conservative families were less happy, more prone to crying, and yet by the time they became adults or conservative adults report being more happy, I'm wondering if part of that is not what people choose to project or to tell, to show the world or to tell study makers.
Yeah, yeah, we hear your point, Brenda. Thank you. Such an interesting question, Arthur Brooks. If a Democrat had ended up in the White House, could a conservative still be happy?
The answer is that, we have looked at that. And the data go all the way back to the early 1970s. And conservatives have always been happier. The happiness gap between right and left has persisted for more than 30 years. And what that tells us, I mean, this is during Jimmy Carter. This is during Bill Clinton. Conservatives didn't like those presidents, but they were still happier, having largely to do with the fact that their happiness, the way that they define their happiness revolves a lot around their private lives, as does it does for liberals. And that means that politics matters a little bit per se, but who's in the White House matters a lot less than we'd think. And so if, you know, assuming that, as many people do, that a Democrat wins the election in 2008, a lot of my liberal friends are going to be happy to see conservatives sad about that, but the conservatives are still going to have the happiness edge after the election.
I'm interested in what you both think in your research, what you found in your research about money and happiness. Happiness. Does money bring happiness? Alan Krueger?
Well, I would say some, and probably not as much as most people expect. And I actually did a study with my co-authors on how much people expect income to affect people's happiness, and people tend to greatly exaggerate the effect of income on happiness. That said, we do find a relatively strong correlation between income and measures of happiness. People also do have a tendency to adapt to their situation. So if they are fortunate and win the lottery, for example, their happiness, subjective well-being goes up, but it seems to be, to a large extent, temporary, transitory. They then tend to return close back to where they were before. So one thing I think which is very important in thinking about income and happiness is that the way we spend our income, what we use it for, do we use it to buy good experiences? Do we use it to spend time together with friends in social environments and so on, is really most important to me about aspect about money and happiness.
What about your research, Arthur Brooks?
Well, everything that Alan says is exactly spot on with what I've found. And there's one other point I think that's worth making. There is one way that you definitely can buy happiness, and that's by giving your money away. There's abundant research that shows that, you know, I can offer you $1,000 in happiness right now if you give it to your favorite charity. People who give money to charity are far happier than people who don't. And there's even evidence from tests where psychologists have done natural experiments on people, exposing them to charitable experiences, that when people give their time or money away, they get happier after the experience. And the, you know, this is the secret to buying happiness that I think that all of us in our personal lives can avail ourselves of, and that even in our public policies, we need to take more seriously. Hmm.
Jack Beatty, I want you to jump in. Go ahead.
Well, in my naive way, I question Professor Brooks, your contention that, quote, in terms of happiness, unlike income, Americans are really quite equal. I'm wondering whether what you're measuring is the human necessity of reaching an equilibrium with one's condition. You can call it resignation with a happy face. If you don't reach that equilibrium, it seems to me you're unhappy. And that this sort of homeostatic mechanism of the psyche, it's a sanity mechanism, really, disguised as contentment. And so I would be, I put that to you as an alternative hypothesis.
Yeah, I mean, that's reasonable that people actually have a need to be happy. And so no matter what their conditions are, they will somehow adapt to it. But we do know that there are all of these outside exogenous conditions in our lives that will affect where that equilibrium is going to be, which is why certain countries appear to be happier than others, why certain communities are happier than other people. And in point of fact, one of the things that we find, for example, in the United States is that the equilibrium happiness is probably, as it is in Europe, rather high, having to do with the fact that we enjoy certain freedoms. We have, we're not worried about finding food in the supermarket when we go there. We're not worried about getting beaten up when we go to the political, when we go to the election polls. There's a lot of things that we take for granted that dramatically raise that equilibrium point. So even if there is an element of that, I think it's rather high and fairly uniform in most developed countries.
Professor Krueger, what are your thoughts about the differences between American happiness and happiness among Europeans or others around the world?
Well, this is an area where I think we do get something of a difference depending upon the measures. So what Arthur said, I think, is exactly right if you look at the more conventional questions about satisfaction with one's life. The Americans come off as quite satisfied. On the other hand, I think there are some cultural tendencies for Americans to be more emphatic than others in many other countries. So we did a study comparing French and American women where we had them keep or provide diary information about how they were feeling moment to moment, and then also ask questions about overall life satisfaction. And what we found was that the ranking reversed. The Americans were more satisfied with their lives, but if we looked at measures of their happiness moment to moment, or probably more important, measure of their misery, the Americans were more unhappy. And I would also add, when we look at the distributions of misery across people, we find that there's a more unequal distribution in the U.S., and that's partly, I think, related to the more unequal distribution of income in the U.S. Then the last thing I would just mention is we also do find, and I think this is related to Jack's question, pretty strong relationships between the amount of pain people feel in their daily lives and their income. It's partly related, I think, to the jobs they do, and also a recent study by Justin Wolfers and Betsy Stevenson looked across countries and found that countries with lower GDP per capita, people were a lot more likely to feel pain from day to day.
Back to those first numbers that you gave, the American women and the French women, it makes me wonder, you know, do we as Americans have too high of expectations in everything we do? Do we set the bar too high in many regards to being happy?
I just want to jump in here. When I talk to Europeans, they'll frequently tell me that they're reluctant to talk about happiness per se because of the effect that might have on their happiness. I'm married to a Spaniard, and when I was first doing this research, she said, "I would never say I'm happy in a survey because I'm convinced that it would turn my luck on me." It's sort of superstitious in a way.
That's right,
Professor Krueger.
Well, we do find some cultural differences. I tend to interpret them more as differences in reporting. And the measures that I prefer for comparing countries, which are really just getting off the ground, look moment to moment at how people are feeling, how happy, how sad, how angry, how tense, pain, and so on. And we try to classify each moment as a pleasant or an unpleasant moment. And that, in some ways, is immune to some of the cultural differences in reporting, because if people are inclined not to go to the extremes of the scales on both the positive and the negative emotions, that kind of cancels out. So that's one way of getting around this problem. But by the way, Jane, if I
yes,
may,
please.
You mentioned I was in France.
Oh, yes. Tell us about your trip. What are you doing there for the French government?
Well, President Sarkozy has set up a commission it's called the Commission on Economic Performance and Social Progress, to consider various measures of societal well-being. And this was our inaugural meeting. It's being chaired by Joe Stieglitz from Colombia. And one small thing I would add is that it's not just focused on France. It's also trying to come up with a set of measures or evaluate a set of measures which can be used for a number of countries.
Let's go to the phones. I want to invite some listeners who are lined up here to get in. So let me welcome first Dan, who's in Spokane, Washington. Dan, welcome to the program.
Hello, Jane.
Hi.
Did I hear Jack Beatty there?
He is here.
Yes.
I wonder if I could throw a question at Jack Beatty and perhaps Arthur Brooks both.
Okay, go ahead.
I subscribe to the notion that long-term mental health depends on an adherence to the truth and to objective reality. And I wonder if I find it interesting when I go look at reviews for Arthur Brooks' book, I find Newt Gingrich weighing in, along with Michael Barone, P.J. O'Rourke, David Frum, and Carl Schramm, who's president of the Catholic League for Religious and Civil Rights. These are all boilerplate conservatives. And it occurs to me that perhaps Mr. Brooks' book demonstrates that ignorance is bliss. I wonder if Jack would weigh in on that, and perhaps Mr. Brooks also.
All right, Dan, thanks.
Well, you know, John Stuart Mill beat me to the punch. He said once, "I'd rather be an unhappy Socrates than a happy pig." And what he meant there was that to be conscious is to be unhappy. To be conscious is to face the world's evil. To be conscious is to recognize, is to fight against the sense of inevitability. And it's when people recognize that things aren't inevitable, that the way things are is not the way they have to be, that's when the sentiment of injustice arises. And I think that is a difference between liberals and conservatives. I think to be a conservative is to, by definition, accept more of the given as the way things should be. And I think that would be a key difference. I'm not saying that I'm not going along with the happy pig, but Mill put it, I think, very vividly there.
Professor Brooks?
Well, you know, I quoted that very quote in my book of John Stuart Mill. And, you know, I make no claims that conservatives are righter or better or that they somehow deserve to be happier. I'm simply looking at the facts on the matter. It's probably true that there's differences in views on complexity. It's probably also true that liberals are far, far more likely to accept the status as victims and victims of circumstance. And, you know, whether that's appropriate or right or whether or not it's a good strategy for life or communities or families or even our nation, you know, that's up to individuals to decide. So I make no claim on that. Now, to actually suggest that, you know, all of these are somehow, deeply conservative types of claims for any reasons of advocacy, that's not what my research is about, notwithstanding the fact that, you know, sorry, Newt Gingrich likes my book. Actually, I'm not sorry about it, but, you know, your listener might regret it.
All right. Thank you. Let's go to the phones again for another question by Lewis, who's calling from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Lewis, what's your question? Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I was wondering if in your study you took attention to stress in relationship to happiness. In my own study, I found it directly related. I also grew up in New York where there were different ethnic groups, And I noticed different ethnic groups had different levels of happiness. Did you take ethnicity into consideration? Mm-hmm. And by the way, I understand that Denmark was the happiest country in Europe. And my last question is, the folks that are doing the study in France right now, I didn't get the list or the heading of what their study is. Can I look it up?
All right. Thanks so much, Lewis. Professor Kruger, first, stress and ethnicity.
Well, there's quite a bit there. The first part on stress, we generally find that positive and negative emotions move in opposite directions. So people who have more stress are generally less happy. Interestingly, when you look moment to moment, positive feelings like feeling happy and feeling enjoyment tend to be very highly correlated, and negative ones like feeling stressed or sad or pain are much more weakly correlated. And I think the saying that there's one way to feel happy and many ways to feel bad seems to describe the data. We do see racial and ethnic differences. I suspect that they are very real differences. African Americans, on our measures, experience more unhappiness and have more pain day to day in their lives, more stress. The question that he raised about Denmark is an interesting one, and there's a puzzle in this area because the Danes come off as off the charts in terms of being satisfied with their lives and being happy in a number of dimensions. So, for example, work has found that the Danes are considerably more satisfied with their health than our French people, but the French live a little bit longer, which again gets back, I think, to cultural differences in reporting. And I think for doing cross-country comparisons, it's important to try to have some procedure for taking those into account.
I'm curious, before we go to the break here, on a very personal note, how the professors rate their own happiness. Professor Brooks?
I've been getting that question a lot, as you can imagine. I'm a very happy person, but I think that a big part of that is actually writing a book on happiness. Knowledge is power. Our behaviors and attitudes affect our happiness a lot. Understanding whether or not we should feel like victims, whether or not we should pursue money, you know, these are things that we can decide ourselves. Now, there's one interesting study out there that had a lot of personal meaning for me that was by a couple of British economists who were looking at the unhappiest year of a man's life. Turns out to be the age 44. That's when men, on average, are most unhappy with their lives. Now, my 44th birthday is in 3 weeks, right after. So this is really relevant for me right now.
Don't buy a Porsche.
Exactly right. I mean, this is, and you know, Alan would give me that advice right now for sure anyway, but the question is why. And the consensus appears to be that age 44 is when your spouse definitively figures out that you're a bore, number one. Number two is when you have adolescence in the home. And number three is when you figure out that your real sense of success and your money, your job, have diverged. And you're saying, my goodness, I'm a lawyer and I hate my job, but I've got this mortgage.
My husband is 44, actually just turned, so I'll break the news to him when I get home.
That's right. Tell him to write a book on happiness.
Arthur Brooks, Alan Kruger, Jack Beatty, hold on. We are discussing America's gross national happiness. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. More to come after this break. This is On Point.
Happiness is when you really feel good about somebody. There's nothing wrong being in love with someone.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We are discussing happiness in America and how new research changes our view of well-being. Joining me today are Alan Kruger, professor at Princeton University, Arthur Brooks, professor at Syracuse University and author of the new book Gross National Happiness, and Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst. Professor Kruger, I'm interested to hear your response to the question that I asked before the break. How do you rate your own happiness?
No, I was hoping to evade that question.
No way.
I'm a few years older than Arthur, so maybe I'm happy as a result.
Past the hump, Alan.
Yeah, just well, you know, given the way you estimate things, I would say you probably couldn't reject statistically that I'm at the at the trough. But anyway, I tend to think about it in terms of domains of my life, and there are certainly many domains where I'm extremely happy. I also tend to think about it in terms of not just happiness, but other emotions. And given the way I organize my life, I would say I have a fair amount of stress. You know, stress comes from deadlines, from time pressure, and things like that. So I tend to think of it as a little bit more nuanced. And I also agree wholeheartedly with what Arthur said about the importance of feeling engaged in some knowledge-producing activity. I find that extremely, extremely rewarding.
Can you talk more, Professor Krueger, about this issue of time management and how that's such a big factor in well-being? Because as I read the study, I mean, I found that one to be one of the most interesting points.
Sure. I think, you know, one of the things that we can't control about our lives is how we spend our time. And ultimately, that's the most important constraint we have. We only have so much time. And there is an aspect to people's subjective well-being, which I think is beyond their control. People tend to have a fairly stable point in terms of life satisfaction. So one way in which they can affect their well-being, I think, is in the way that they choose to spend their time. And we found a number of kind of regular patterns. People seem to be happiest when they're engaged socially, when they're with friends or their spouse. Exercise seems to be associated with very, very positive emotions. Interestingly, especially for men, when people exercise, the amount of pain they have goes up, but their amount of happiness goes up even more. People enjoy eating. Religious activity scores very high. When we look at people, in general, I would say the kinds of activities that people choose to do voluntarily, they tend to enjoy more while they're doing it. The one kind of surprising activity, given how much time people spend doing it, is television. And I think people often regret a lot of the time they spent watching television. But Americans spend an enormous amount of time watching television, and that's associated with, you know, fairly mild positive feelings. In the data that we've looked at, not nearly as positive as exercising or meeting friends for dinner, for example. And for some of this, you might worry a little bit that, there are different people, and different people engage in different activities. But even when we look at the same person go through his or her day, we see changes in their level of subjective well-being as they go from one activity to another. And even there, we find that when someone goes from a more social environment to watching television, their positive emotional experience seems to decline.
Hmm. That's so interesting. Let's get another caller in here. Sherry is in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Sherry, welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Yeah, I kind of, it's funny because I've been studying this a lot lately in terms of the Eastern religions and stuff, and I think that happiness is really a moment-by-moment thing, and I think probably the researchers have found that out because they're asking people to pay attention moment-by-moment.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that our happiness comes from our thoughts and our thinking about our life, and so that the way to find true happiness is in the moment by choosing best feeling thoughts that you can come up with.
So Sherry is saying, yeah, happiness is a mindset, is what I'm hearing, Professor Krueger?
Well, I think there's something to that. I think what we pay attention to matters, and choosing to pay attention to positive things or positive aspects of an activity. But I think the way I view people's happiness is broader than just how they feel moment to moment. You know, if you take Arthur's example, which I agree with, people feel better about themselves when they give money away. And I don't think it's just the moment that they actually wrote the check. I think it lasts longer. I think it changes the way they evaluate themselves as persons or as people. And I think that's another way of viewing people's well-being.
Mm. Professor Brooks, do you have thought?
Yeah, there's what happiness is really depends on what you're trying to look at. I mean, looking moment to moment is legitimate, of course, and that's why Alan's work with the French, with the Europeans, is so critically important, because we assess on balance our happiness in different ways, but moment to moment we're going to get greater fidelity on this. So moment to moment is what, you know, a lot of psychologists would refer to as fleeting feelings of happiness that add up ultimately on balance to something like, do you think you have a happy life, which is a slightly, you know, higher aggregated level of happiness. And at the top level, if you go back to Aristotle, it's the idea of a good life well lived. One of your callers asked a moment ago about, you know, whether or not isn't that the right kind of happiness we should be looking at, is, you know, whether we have truth and beauty on or truth and light on our side somehow. And the answer is yes. All of these things are happiness. They're just at different levels. They mean different things at different times to us, and we really need to look at all of them philosophically, empirically, and moment to moment.
Sherry, thanks for the call and the question. Now to John, who's in Newburyport, Massachusetts. John, welcome to On Point.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, fine.
I just wanted to start by saying that I recently pushed through the age 44, and I have to say I think you're onto something. But it does sort of set up my question. You know, I'm thinking about the whole idea of how much we consume in this society and what's the correlation between consumption and perhaps a lack of happiness. I think we're taught to believe that we constantly need things that we don't need. And I wonder if we're at a point of reckoning where people are starting to detach themselves from the myth of consumption. I think, you know, the theory of conspicuous consumption really came into being in the 19th century and came into practical application in the 20th century. And I wonder if we've hit a dead end with it. We also have a huge ecological crisis that seems to be indicating that we need to really rethink what we consume and how we consume.
John,
and
thanks. Thank you. I appreciate your call. It's a great question. Happiness and consumerism. Professor Kruger, Professor Brooks?
Well, I would say that there's something to what John was describing, and I think part of it is we're bombarded with advertisements for material consumption, less so for how to use your leisure time in productive ways, because there's no industry or few industries that make money from organizing the way you spend your time with your family when you're at home. But there are industries that make money from selling you a new car or a new pair of shoes and so on. I don't see much change in Americans' behavior. What's remarkable to me about Americans is how much of our income we spend. And I can say as an economist, it seems to me that I don't see much of a switch in terms of spending more of our income on buying leisure as opposed to buying material goods. Mm.
Professor Brooks.
It's materialism and consumerism are unambiguously a big problem in many people's lives. And I view the tend toward materialism as a big measurement problem. And I think about my students who have a measurement problem. They come to me and they ask me about their grades. They don't care about their grades. They care about how they're performing in the class, but they focus on the measure. We do the same thing typically in our lives when we look at the amount of money that we make, the amount of material things that we have. They don't bring us joy because they don't measure the real things that bring us joy. If you look at the data on people who really are happier than others, one of the things that you'll find is they feel personally successful in terms of creating value the way they define it. That frequently is highly correlated with the amount of money that they have. And the mistake that people make is saying, well, I'm really successful and I can measure my paycheck, so therefore I'm just going to try to maximize my paycheck. And guess what? Age 44 comes along and it turned out to be a big mistake. So this is something that I think that we can really all keep in mind, is trying to think about value, success in creating value, as opposed to consumerism, and we can make better decisions.
Aaron is on the line now from Providence, Rhode Island. Aaron, welcome to the program.
You've mentioned age 44 a few times, and I was wondering if either of the researchers looked at aging and happiness. Do we get happier or less happy as we get older? Are baby boomers happier than the silent generation? I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Glad you brought it up, Aaron. Thanks so much for the call. Professor Kruger?
Well, I can tell you with the data that I've studied, we do find that older people are happier and have less stress, less misery in their lives. And you know, if you needed a rule of thumb, age 44 for kind of where things peak is not a bad rule of thumb. I mostly compared people over age 65 to younger people. And for people over age 65, what we tend to find is that the strength of negative emotions tend to fade. Positive emotions are not quite as strong either, but they don't fade nearly as much. And part of that we trace back to the way people spend their time. People are over 65 are working less for pay. They're spending more time in leisure pursuits. And I think that's part of the explanation. That's not the whole explanation. But I'd add that there's a large literature by psychologists looking at feelings for the elderly. And what they tend to find is that people seem to learn to ignore some of the negative slights, some of the slights that we encounter in our daily lives, and that seems to help.
Mm. Professor Brooks.
Yeah, it's interesting if you look back to the 1970s, and the work that I've seen from the 1970s suggests that old people today are happier than old people used to be. So the question is why? Why is that? That today, when you retire, you can look forward to being a happier person than you are when you're in your 30s or 40s or maybe even in your 50s. This is a wonderful thing, but it appears to be a kind of a new phenomenon, and it probably has a lot to do with the fact that life as an old person is a lot better than it used to be. We can expect better health outcomes. We have a lot more independence. You know, people frequently regret the fact that families, extended families, are breaking up as people move around, but this has not really necessarily been a bad thing for the happiness of old people who are not reliant on their adult children to, support them while they live in the attic anymore. That's sort of a thing of the past, and being independent and having good health. When you have more time to do things like volunteer for good charities, well, this is really a recipe for happiness.
Mm-hmm. Jane, could I add this?
Yes, Professor.
This is an area where the U.S. looks better than many countries. And if you look at developing countries, age has much more of a debilitating effect on people's feeling about their happiness and their health. Also, the former Soviet Union states, you see a very different pattern than you see in the U.S.
Jack
Beatty and I think, as Arthur said, that's related to the changes and progress that have taken place in society.
Jack Beatty, go ahead.
And it's partly a monument to politics. The New Deal. Franklin Roosevelt was once asked, what's your philosophy? What's the philosophy of the New Deal? And he said one word, security. He said, we've all had to take our chances with old age. We've all had to take our chances with unemployment. We've all had to take our chances with being injured on the job. I think Americans don't need to take so many chances. I think they can be happier if they have a modicum of security. And I think what we see with our older population is some of that. Medicare and Social Security says, one, you're not going to be thrown out on the street as you were before Social Security, and two, you're not going to become medically indigent in this country. These are triumphs that I think go to increase the national happiness.
Thank you, Jack. Let's go to another call. Carl is in Boston, Massachusetts. Carl, welcome.
Hi, fascinating conversation. I just wanted to point out something that I think has been sort of alluded to, but make it explicit, that if I, informed disclaimer here, I'm a neuroscientist and study child development as well. It strikes me that, and this is probably obvious, but I think it's still worth saying that I haven't read the original study.
I've got to move you along. I'm running out of time, Carl. Go ahead with your question.
It's reporting largely correlations. That is, it's equally plausible that not that marriage makes one happy, but that happy people seek marriage. Mm-hmm. It's equally plausible not that religion makes one happy, but the people who want an explanatory system that is sanguine in general will seek it. This is really Jack Beatty's point, but one can synthesize it with the children. The rigid children who cry can easily be children who are frustrated by life, and they have that rigid disposition, and then they seek what I think it was Weber called elective affinity. Jack can correct me. They seek explanatory models that conform to their innate disposition.
I hear your question, and I want to get an answer to it. Professor Kruger, could all this data just be, correlations?
Well, you have to worry that correlation is not causality. I think we make some take some precautions to avoid that. For example, you could look at people before and after they get married, and we do see some changes in their reported well-being. Also, on religion, we could look at the religious people and non-religious people, and then look at the religious person while that person engages in religious activities. And as Arthur mentioned earlier, there have been experiments a lot of experiments in this area. So I think it's more than just correlational data. Although a lot of the literature is correlational, and I think one, of course, has to be cautious about drawing causal inferences with observational data.
Professor Brooks, I'll give you the last word.
Thanks. The one thing that's worth pointing out is that the politics stuff is correlational, that groups of conservatives are happier than groups of liberals. The causal stuff that's really interesting is how they do things in their life, with their marriage, with their children, what they do about their faith. And those studies are a lot better with trying to establish causation, which is to say, if you want to get happy, don't just go vote a different way, but rather think about how happy people live their lives and copy those things. Mm.
What a fascinating hour. I want to thank all of my guests today. Arthur Brooks of Syracuse University. His new book is Gross National Happiness. Professor, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
And Alan Krueger of Princeton University. Good luck in France with your experiments, and thank you for your time today.
Thanks very much.
And Jack Beatty, as always, On Point news analyst, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Appreciate it, Jack.
Thank you, Jane.
Listeners, continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
But I think he knows. So